welcome to the Jericho Comedy Podcast. While we can't do our regular shows, we want to connect you with some of our great acts. I'm Connor McReynolds, and today I'm chatting to the wonderful Ben Pope. Ben is a superb writer and performer. He was president at the prestigious Cambridge Footlights, and he's one of the very best storytelling comics in the UK. If you've seen him at Jericho Comedy before, you know how great he is. I am really excited for you guys to get to know Ben a little bit better in this episode. We'll also be playing you a little something from our fantastic charity partner, Oxfordshire Mind. And later in the podcast, you get to hear Ben in action at Jericho Comedy, back in the times when we could all get together on a Saturday night. Right now, though, here he is, Mr. Ben Pope. Ben, hello. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Connor. What a dream.
How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. I've just come back to London after 3 months living on the south coast with my parents in lockdown. So I'm feeling very overwhelmed and scared by all the fast-moving vehicles and people.
I'm imagining it's kind of a proper case of sensory overload after being by a lovely, peaceful coast.
Oh, 100%, 100%. I'm like a new puppy being acclimatized to a house. It's like it's freaking out about everything. Yeah, it's full on.
How was your time on the coast? Was it a kind of good opportunity for you to sort of center yourself and relax a little bit? Or
yes and no. It's very nice to be in the countryside. That's always lovely. As most comedians, I'm sure, who you talked to have said, you know, there's no work at all. So I have been freed up. But I have, I was looking after my parents. I was doing a lot of gardening for them, trying to sort of summon my inner Monty Don. It's been all right. Stressful in its own way. But a different genre of stress.
It's so weird, isn't it, that there are the kind of pros and cons, because spending some time by the coast gardening in any other time sounds truly idyllic, but as you say, when you couple it with a global pandemic and the collapse of our entire industry, it sort of balances out a bit, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a real it sort of feels a bit like fiddling while Rome burns.
Very much so.
Yeah, all very lovely, but the entire swim to the sea.
Have you been able to, because I've been seeing and casting very envious glances at all of these comedians who are using lockdown very productively to achieve a lot of things, and I am not one of those people. Are you in my boat? Yuck. Or
I'm I am, not only am I in your boat, I think I'm the running the motor at the back. That is, I've absolutely I've done nothing. I have, you know, I kept writing stuff in notebooks and diaries and whatnot, but yeah. It does feel like just yelling, screaming into a void, because it's the closest, you know what it is, it's the closest I've been to being like a teenager again, because not only did I move back in with my parents for a while, I was also writing jokes that I now, you know, will possibly never be able to perform, which is pretty much how I spent my entire teenager preparing to try and be a stand-up comedian, with absolutely zero outlet for that, because you can't be a 14-year-old who gets up on stage and pretends to have a life. It was really weird. But I've not created much. I find it very stressful. I haven't had the, I guess I haven't had the motivation. There hasn't been like a, I don't have my own podcast, or I don't have a Twitch stream or anything.
Are you someone who kind of needs to have a deadline or something to kind of work towards to motivate you?
Yeah, Definitely. Or at least a project I know is going to be created.
Yeah,
it's always the problem I found with, like, I love stand-up because you can think of something that day and then go that evening and go and blast it out onto the stage and put it in front of people. Whereas, like, anytime I've tried to write scripts, you know, the whole thing just seems like a suspension of any actual realistic end of any endpoint to it, because you just never know if it'll ever be made, if it'll ever get put on somewhere. So it does feel like you have to really fight. You have to fight with reality on that one. Whereas jokes, you can just, like, well, just like jokes, you know, so, jokes, because they feel like little gifts, you know. You don't the first idea for something just comes out of the middle of nowhere, and then you can go and try it out that evening. Whereas with, like, scripts, it always feels like every little bit of it has to be hammered out, like, on, it feels more like being a blacksmith than being a writer.
I like that. You've got to forge something out of fire. You've touched on a couple of things there, Ben, that I'd really like to talk to you about. The first is, you mentioned that you were thinking about stand-up comedy as a teenager. Is this something that you've always wanted to do? And if so, kind of, what's your first memory of being funny?
It is something I sort of always wanted. I know very clearly when it became something that I was like, I've got to do that. When I was about 13, I started, like, acting in plays at school. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of so aware that it was like a complete surprise to me that I was any good at it. And I immediately loved performing and being in front of people doing stuff. And then when I was about 14, 15, I came home from school once and I watched a Bill Bailey show that was on Channel 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such a kind of, like, light bulb moment, to use the big, you know, cliche. Suddenly I was like, oh, this is amazing. And my brain was already like, oh, I can see how he's doing that, and I can pick apart what's going on here. And I think I could do that. I wanted to get into that there and then. I was sort of aware that I probably wasn't, you know, I had been funny in my life, but I couldn't put a finger on, like, exactly when and why. So it almost became more like a kind of, you know, I know I can perform. Can I now study the greats and see if I can make this, can I sort of retroactively, like, turn this performance gene into something fun and funny. So I just ended up, like, watching loads of YouTube videos.
Yeah, you mentioned studying the greats. Is that something that you kind of find yourself doing as a teenager, watching comedians and sort of almost like analyzing the structure of jokes and that kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. I mean, I think it's hard to sort of studying. It makes it sound really dry and dull. I was just obsessed with it. Like, I thought it was amazing. Yeah. And I thought it was incredible. And in that way, when you're reading something amazing or you're watching, like, a film that you love and you see someone in it and you're like, oh, that actor's amazing. And I want to watch all of the films that they're in. Or, or if you, like, really into sports and you're like, oh, that, you know, I want to follow that team now. It's the same sort of thing. It was like, I have, like, a deep, like, need. I had a deep, like, need to go and watch all of that stuff and it was enjoyable, but almost in an academic way, like, fascinating as well as fun.
Yeah, you mentioned Bill Bailey and you watched that show and that was kind of your light bulb moment. But his style is kind of musical comedy and that kind of thing. Were there any influences or any acts that you watched that you think really directly influenced your kind of comic persona or your onstage style?
I guess so. Bill Bailey, I would look back to that because I do think, like, you know, obviously he's a musical comedian and I don't, in terms of persona and stuff, I don't, nothing like him really. But I do think, like, the spirit of his work is really exciting because it's so kind of mag pie-ish. You know, its stories and its bits and its, you know, musings and little ideas, and also it, you know, given that it's quite weird for like that to be the first experience you have of stand-up, I think, like, most people, actually I don't know if this is true of most people, but like I think there's definitely a case of classic stand-up being most people's way in. You know, you see a stand-up on TV and they're doing just like, you know, observational, classic observational stuff, you know, sort of Seinfeld-esque kind of thing. But Bill Bailey, it was like so intelligent, and it was kind of intelligent stupidity. And I always thought that was like, there was a real craft behind it. And I think that the spirit of that, of being like curious and trying to make something weird and silly, but out of things that were genuinely very interesting, that I like to think is the sort of the spirit I throw into stuff. I mean, in terms of persona, I was really obsessed with Dylan Moran when I was a teenager as well. I just thought he was the most, like, and again, not someone that I hugely resemble in any way, but again, the spirit of like of the poetry of it all, that everything could be, every word is really important, and you can ring really interesting and still observational, still like deeply like relatable material, but you can ring it out of these really obscure angles and weird phrasings and poetry basically. I think those two were like, that was the sort of the kickoff point.
They are two fantastic influences to have. I love that phrase that you used, intelligent stupidity. And I think, is that something that you like, an idea that you like to play with in your material? Kind of, for anybody who's listening who hasn't had the good fortune of seeing you live, what would be a kind of typical bit of Ben Pope material? What kind of things do you like to play with?
I really like, telling stories, but I like, the thing I try to aim for is I try to take like quite relatable content, but approach it in quite a I suppose like a cerebral way of getting to a joke. So I like intelligent ideas expressed stupidly. I have a long bit about going to the gym and how it's sort of insane that we use treadmills, because they're all you're doing there is essentially you've collapsed the spatial plane. You've reduced running down to literally running on a spot, and that being like a leisure activity, like a guinea pig. And obviously the bit is considerably funnier than the way I'm expressing it right there. But like, I think that's such a, it's such an interesting idea that is something that, as like a society, we've taken on as like a really good use of our time, literally to run on the spot like morons. And I think like I then express that within like a longer rant about like how gym is awful. But taking something like that, which is like, I think there's like a fairly complex idea there, and expressing it through like my own anger and sort of stupidity with it, I think it's, that's the way. And to be honest, I mean, I say that's my particular view. That's a lot of comedians' ways of expressing themselves, I think, is you take a concept or a nugget of something that's actually quite hard to unpack, and you express it in a very like simple everyday way. And it takes something quite kind of bulky potentially and makes it immediately accessible and like laughable, you know. I've made this all sound very dry. Not funny anyway.
You mentioned the word anger in there, but that isn't necessarily a quality that I would associate with your comedy. But perhaps it's maybe there's anger in the idea, but very much not in the delivery, because it's a very charming, friendly delivery, I think, quite calm.
Oh, well, that's kind. I mean, yeah, I think anger is probably the wrong word. Occasionally I have little sort of flurries of, I think, anger is the wrong word, bemusement, or I guess, mild, kind of in the mode of like David Mitchell getting incredibly het up about something very small. I suppose.
Yes,
like
absolutely. Kind of inconsequential things that become huge.
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, you mentioned David Mitchell there, and that kind of leads me on to a question about your position as president of the Cambridge Footlights. I mean, that for so many people, the Cambridge Footlights are kind of the stepping stone into comedy. I mean, there are comedians like Sarah Pascoe who applied to Cambridge solely to be a part of that group. Was that a part of your thinking when you applied to Cambridge? Was the Footlights always something that you wanted to be a part of?
Yeah, honestly, desperately. Yeah, that was a large. I was very like nerdy academic teenager, so I was sort of had it in my sights anyway because I was interested in it as an institution, and I wanted anyone who wants to go to university was keen to go to a good uni. But I was very, particularly by the time I was about to leave school, I was very, very excited about doing like theatre and comedy. And I knew that it was a really, you go into it knowing that there's a bit of a legacy there, and there's a bit of, there are people, it's a good route in. And particularly, as a comedy, which is such an unstable career, and it's such a strange, seemingly open-ended, it seems like almost impossibly challenging when you've not done it, but also it's so open, anyone could apply to do an open spot or whatever. I think. I saw doing university comedy as a kind of a fairly secure route of like just one way of preparing myself in order to try and attempt a career in comedy. It looked like a good routine, which, I would say it is in some ways, and it isn't in others. I think there's been a lot of chat recently, a lot of discussion in the comedy industry about, privilege of various sorts. And I think people have rightly criticized the fact that, as with pretty much all industries, if someone's been to Oxbridge, there is an enormous amount of privilege that you get. And that's certainly something that I've noticed, that lots of people have noticed, is that, if you do, often people who've gone to the Footlights have, often either leapfrogged or gone straight into stuff like TV and film and that kind of thing. And it seemed almost, that all comes down to like contacts and people you meet at that level. And that is a bit of an unfair advantage. But what I don't think it prepares you for fully is actually the reality of the live circuit. Is it makes you very sure in your own abilities, but doesn't prepare you for hecklers or,
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, when I was chatting to Mickey Overman in last week's episode, she talked about how her first ever gig was after completing a comedy course, and how the audience there were all just sort of friends and family of the people who had done the course. And so it was just the nicest audience in the world. And I had that experience as well. And I would imagine that the kind of Cambridge Footlights audience are all kind of friends or admirers of the group. And yeah, so how was that transition for you? What were the kind of harshest lessons you learned going from that environment into sort of open mics and gigs around London and that kind of thing?
Well, there's a real gear change, and I think on one hand it's very good, and in the same way with that comedy course audience, right, that serves a really good purpose, which is to give you some confidence. You can't do comedy without a certain level of confidence, and you need to know that you need to believe in yourself enough to get over the first hurdle, which is getting up on stage and having a go, right? And that's why, student comedy is very supportive, and it's why those comedy courses are so supportive, because it gives you a free pass to try, which you don't get if you went in straight and you did like an open spot at a comedy club or an open mic, right? You go in very it's a harsh reality, and particularly open mics, particularly in this country, are a fairly brutal, you know, vacuum sealed environment, right?
It certainly can be.
So that first, particularly, I'll tell you what, the first year out of university, I was very lucky to go to the Fringe the year afterwards, and I did, I split an hour with an excellent comedian called Chris MacArthur Boyd, who's Scottish and who is genuinely just a wonderful comedian, and he's like a really good friend. He straddles the line between being an excellent club comic and then also is like has loads of really interesting anecdotal cerebral material as well. So he's like a really like a star written all over him. But I split an hour with him, and it was such a learning curve, because he, who had like built up 5, 10, 20 minutes very slowly on like the Scottish circuit, which is considerably tougher, and I had come in with all of my misplaced confidence, assuming that I could deal with a middle-aged Scottish audience, and I died like every night most nights for a month, and it really taught me to just go back to basics and build up 5 minutes and build up 10 minutes and to do it like from the base upwards.
That's so interesting. Was there
and not to just assume that you can get by on charisma.
Was there a point during that run when it wasn't feeling so good, when you were kind of going up, not getting the reaction you wanted? Did you ever doubt yourself? Or
100%. I mean, you go into that feeling like very unsure of. I the first night, I remember being. It was dreadful, we picked it up by the end of the run. Chris was like reliably very good, particularly on the weekends when there was a fuller crowd. And I remember getting by the end of the, you know, I was trying to record my sets so I should listen back to them, and I couldn't bring myself to do it the next day because I couldn't bear to listen to me doing the same material and it just being and hearing the confidence drain out of my voice, and it really, which sounds horrific, and it is, but but it was like a really good it was a good lesson in just like learning about the broadness of the circuit, and that you're not even there. Like, we were in like a theatery room, but we were getting, you know, gilded balloon audiences, which I'd say is probably a clubbier audience than most of the rest of the fringe audience. And it was, you know, it was a fairly safe space, but I was still struggling. And I think it was a really good lesson in how to serve the audience that you're being dealt, you know, and that is what makes a really good comedian. And I won't say that I'm that, even. I don't even know that I have the full breadth of experience that I could have at this point in my career. But like, what makes a really good comedian is someone who can play an audience that they get given, and sometimes it's not easy. I had to learn that the hard way, and it made me sit back and look at the material that I had and work it harder. And also it made me retreat a little bit from, it made me throw myself into tougher gigs, but also remember that, you know, that there was stuff that I loved, the stuff that I loved doing, and some of it wasn't working with this particular audience, but that didn't mean that it wasn't good and that it wouldn't serve someone, but it was just learning how to present the right stuff to the right people. You know, if you have a very vulnerable story and you don't want to throw that at a, you know, at a Saturday night glee club crowd, you save that for the vegan cafe gig, right? But you know, if you have 10 minutes of sex escapade stories and one-liners, then obviously that's going to work better in certain, and you just learn to deal with those different audiences better.
It's so interesting having
again,
that
I won't say that I'm
well let me say it for you. You are wonderful, and every time you've come to Jericho Comedy, you've always pitched the gig just right. And you mentioned those kind of sort of vegan cafe type gigs. I think Jericho probably falls into that category a little bit. You've got that experience of having performed for Cambridge audiences, and you've come to Oxford a lot. Am I artificially kind of manufacturing a sort of similarity between those crowds, or does Oxford feel like a different type of gig to some of the London ones you do?
Oh, definitely. It is. I think it is. It is very different. I mean, you know, when you say it's in the vegan cafe sort of wheelhouse, it is in some ways for sure. But equally, you know, I you've got, I don't know how many gigs you have running now in central Oxford, but you know, I've done the bottom of the Jericho Cafe sometimes when it has been like, you know, we've had all sorts of, there's been a lot more like audience interaction than at a very like pristine theatre gig. You know, it's been, it has a nice range. You do get a mixture of students, and you get a mixture of people from the town, right, who've come for a night out, who, you know, could have gone to, you know, another one of the clubs in Oxford. So you do get a really it's why I like to come and play with you guys, is because it's such a it's very useful. It's a kind audience, but they won't suffer fools. It's always going to be a walk in the park. So yeah. It's a good place to, like, you know, try stuff out and
yeah, it's still a Saturday night and people want a good time, so you've got to, exactly, to satisfy the audience. Yeah. But as you say, they are generally, absolutely, so lovely and will be very patient with people. You know, we do try to give newer performers a chance, or maybe taking their first steps into comedy, and then people like yourself who are very much more kind of polished and really confident in their voice. So yeah, it's I feel very lucky to be associated with Jericho, because I just love it as a club. I think I'm a bit spoiled because the majority of the gigs I do are there, so I have this idea of comedy that it's every gig is that nice, and then you go somewhere else and realize, oh no, Jericho's quite special.
For sure.
Well, Ben, this is great. I mean, thank you so much for all of that. I could keep talking to you all day, but right now I've got to go to a little clip from our brilliant charity partner, Oxfordshire Mind. Here they are.
The outbreak of coronavirus is affecting all of our lives in lots of different ways, and in these uncertain times, we are seeing a surge in demand for our services. Last month, we had a 390% increase in crisis calls to our information line and a 117% increase in calls to our benefits advice service, supporting people in financial need to claim the benefits they are entitled to. We are still here for you, your friends, colleagues and communities. Our services are still running, albeit in a different way, but we need your support to help us continue. Please make a donation to Oxfordshire Mind so we can continue to make sure anyone with a mental health problem has somewhere to turn for advice and support. You can donate via our website at oxfordshiremind.org.uk, and you can also find free and fun, exciting ways to fundraise for the team via virtual fundraising ideas.
Okay, Ben, this is the point in the podcast where I stop being friendly and instead I become very serious and demanding. I'm going to be asking you a series of challenging, provocative questions here, and all I need from you are some honest answers. Can you do that?
I'm scared, but I'm prepared. Yeah, let's do it.
That should be the name of the section, Scared But Prepared. Right, let's go into this. Ben, do you think that the English language would be better or worse if we gendered objects like some other European nations?
Oh, as in like having le or la?
Absolutely,
or,
yeah.
I don't think it would. I think it's deeply, you know, we live in a very exciting times when gender is more fluid than ever. I can't imagine that it would make anything more confusing than to suddenly have to work out whether or not a table had a penis or not, and whether that even mattered.
I do.
We've all got enough on our plates already. And those plates themselves don't need to be gentle. So I'm saying no. It's a strong no for me.
I think that is a very sensible answer. Ben, how much cheese would a friend have to eat before you staged an intervention?
I think that I'm gonna say it's an infinite amount. I really like cheese. Uh-huh. So if anyone was going to go on full out on a kind of Grand Boeuf style like suicide cheese pact, I would probably join them. I would very enable this cheese death. So
death by cheese sounds wonderful.
Doesn't it? It'd be a smelly death.
It would be, yeah. But not your problem. Ben, who, in your opinion, is the best Muppet and why?
Oh, huge question. These really are pressing questions, actually. I'm a big fan of, you know what? I really like the little one. I can't remember his name. His name's like Scooter or something.
The director.
Yeah, who has the little glasses and the little... I think that is... He seems to deal with all of the bullshit, you know? everyone else seems to just faff around and he's the one pulling the strings together. And then Kermit gets all of the reward, all of the, like, the kudos for that. I'm very pro Scooter. Also, for a more niche answer, I used to be really, as a kid, I used to be really obsessed with the short-lived 90s Muppets show, which was called Muppets Tonight.
Yes.
It was like a kind of late night talk show thing, right? And I used to love Clifford, who was like the presenter of that, who was especially invented. Wasn't he great? He was like funny.
A kind of Caribbean.
Yeah, Muppet. I mean, we don't need the racial politics of it.
Yeah.
For sure.
He arrived around the same time as Pepe the Prawn. I don't know if you remember Pepe.
Yes, Pepe was a classic. Pepe was lovely.
Two wonderful Muppets. All right, Ben, can you name for me three marsupials?
possibly no. A kangaroo is one.
That's one. Yeah.
A wombat. Is a wombat a marsupial?
Yes, a wombat is a marsupial.
Okay, we're nearly there. Wombat and a koala. I'm going to go koala.
Oh, that was very well played, Ben. You nailed that.
Nice. You just got to go to Australia. That's it.
That's it, yeah.
They all live in Australia.
Just Australian people probably would get you half a point. I don't know if you are kind of technically half marsupial if you're from Australia, but why not? Jericho Comedy would like to disassociate itself from this host's racism. Ben, question 5. Have you ever done the thing where you inhale helium from a balloon to make your voice go squeaky?
I have, yes, with great results. in fact, it's a huge joy. One of the greatest scenes in all of sitcom history is the scene in, I don't know if you've ever watched New Girl, which is the one with Zooey Deschanel in it,
yes.
Where they're all doing helium in the flat, and then Nick Miller comes back in with news that his dad has died, and they all have to console him, but they've all got helium in them. That's a great scene. Great scene.
It's a really great scene. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. That's fantastic. Ben, what color's your toothbrush?
Currently, you know what? I've had a very new and exciting development in that I've gone from acoustic to electric recently. on the opinion of my dentist and family. So I'm now, it's fully like white, maybe some blue stripes on there.
Oh, wow.
And it's so exciting. It's very, the first time I used it, I was worried I was going to like drill through my face or something. It's a very intense experience.
Oh, wow.
It's like giving your teeth a massage. It's great.
Would you recommend it for our listeners?
yeah, if they're into that kind of thing, then yeah, great.
Extraordinary. I recently went to a bamboo toothbrush. Because I read one of those horrifying facts where on Twitter, where I think it must have been Greenpeace or someone said, every toothbrush you've ever owned still exists somewhere in the world. And that just made me think like, oh God, that's awful. So yeah, bamboo toothbrush. But if they start making electric bamboo toothbrushes, that's the dream.
Well, is it? I don't, because you see, you've made me look like an arsehole now, because I've said, you know, oh yeah, plug it in the wall, carbon all the way. And now you come for the greener option. That's a,
that was a real bit of gotcha journalism there. Yeah, that was unfriendly and unnecessary.
This trap.
Well, Ben, on a different subject, what's the secret to really great scrambled eggs?
You know what? It's, again, this is all about reading your audience. You've got to ask them whether you want them, whether people want them wet or dry. You know, old people like dry eggs. And that is, you know, you've got to really overcook them if they're over 60. But for everyone else, it's all about the accessories, right? Cook them quickly in a little wok with pepper, diced chorizo, and maybe a little bit of spinach on the side, and then and buttery toast, and then we're done. I think I've come up with an answer quite quickly on this one because I'm very hungry. So that is
not just a good answer. That is a truly great answer. You sound like a man who knows your way around an egg.
I know my way around an egg and no other foods. I'm a dreadful cook, but I can do brunch. Brunch is the one thing I can do. That's like it, because it's easy. It's all just eggs and bread.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Well done, you. Ben, if you had to come up with the next big crisp flavor, what would it be?
Oh, that's hard. Well, it's tough, isn't it? Because they've tried loads of things now, and lots of them have been. Do you remember when they did try to do tomato ketchup, roughly in the early 2000s?
Yeah.
It was kind of a bit disappointing. Something like, this is like a dating app question. It's truly stumping. Maybe something like some kind of curry that they haven't done before. So like instead of, you know, Thai, I feel like there's a lot of Thai curry crisps, maybe like a kind of, or like Vietnamese cuisine or something. Maybe they could do like a pho crisp, although that, I don't know what that would be. Quite watery.
It might be.
Horrible. As I'm saying it, I'm just like, this is disgusting. What have I done? But you know what? They could do a full English, couldn't they? Imagine if they could do like a Willy Wonka style full English. You
like
know,
a
when
kind
he has
of
that time
release thing. Yeah. There's a great popcorn company that I don't know how they do it, but they've got like three or four flavors in there, and it really is Willy Wonka esque. The one I tried, I think, was like caramel and chili or something. And you put it in and you get the really kind of sweet caramel hit straight away. And then after a little second, you start to get the kind of the chili hit. But they work so well together. I don't know how they do it. They're wizards.
They really are. It's like a science. It's a...
Oh, yeah. Science is probably the answer rather than magic.
Yeah. Almost certainly. Yeah. I was going to put all their effort into... you know, curing one of the many diseases in the world rather than inventing time-release flavors on popcorn. But there we go.
I'm assuming the popcorn industry has now shifted their focus into finding a vaccine. But here's hoping they get done with that quickly, because I really want some more popcorn.
When they do have a vaccine, it'll have a chilly release in 10 seconds.
It's going to taste delicious. Ben, my final question for you is there anything that Meryl Streep can't do?
I don't know her personally, so I can't answer that question to the best of my ability. She probably... no, I'm going to say no. I feel like she's quite a capable lady.
Yeah.
She must be very rich now. So there's, you know, she's got facilities at her disposal.
Yeah, that's true.
She could use all those awards and stack them, melt them down, and turn them into an even bigger award. I don't know what she does with
it. I love that idea that she just makes herself one huge Oscar. That's really fun. Well, there we go. Now, we love nothing more than being in front of our brilliant audiences, introducing you to wonderful acts like Ben, and it feels like a lifetime since we've done that. So to remind us all what that experience sounded like, here's a clip from a live Jericho comedy show featuring none other than our guest this evening, Mr. Ben Pope. Check it out.
I'm a late person, as in I'm late for stuff, I'm not dead. Just have to clarify that sometimes, because it's weird, isn't it, when we refer to dead people, we're like, oh, the late John Smith. It's like, dude, he's not coming. I was born late, and I think that set the tone. I was born 10 days late, which is like, that's late, isn't it? 10 days. And in any other context, that counts as not turning up. That's what I mean. 10 days late for a business meeting, they've cancelled the search party. That's not happening anymore. I'm anyone else here a late person? Give me a yell. What? Who was that? Are you just getting involved because you want to?
Just generally.
That's a yes, yeah. Well, are you either? Are you late for stuff all the time?
Just late.
Yeah. How do you find, do you like it?
It's fine.
Is it? Because I find it exhausting.
Why be early?
Why be early? Why, that's my feeling. Who here's an early person? Yes, polite hands. There's the real divide in the country. That's that's where you guys hate us. Oh boy. Then, yes. That's the hostility. I can feel it. It's radiating off you. I would never say anything against you, early nerds. But I find it amazing because my body just doesn't. I have lots of friends who are like, you're a punch over stuff, and they're always really hostile. They're like Shakespearean about it. They're always just be like. Do you not care that you waste our time? And I'm always like, no. But that's not the reason. The reason I'm late is because my body doesn't like measure time in the same way. Like it just doesn't like, you know, like if someone says to me, oh Ben, you've got 5 minutes to leave the house, my brain is like, oh great, time for a bath and pasta. It's like difficult. I mean, it's so difficult. I also think there's like more romance in being late for stuff. Like, you know, early people get the train, and like more often than not always, but it is like, you know, it's on time, or they tell you when it's coming, and then, you know, if it's not on time, then they tell you why. Whereas buses, which is what I take. Oh, buses. Just measureless, indeterminate waste of time. Oh, I love it. Waiting for a bus is like waiting for a lover to return from war. You're just standing there, just like, oh, I know he's coming. Oh, I don't know when, but I'll know it when I see him. That's just, glowing 37 on his forehead. Like, that's, you know. I love that. You know. Punctual people, what's your name, Adam? No, that's right. You don't have to if you don't want to. That was, we heard the inside thoughts there for a second, didn't we? You guys were, this whole row was punctual people.
We're all capable of telling the time.
You're capable of telling the time. What a slight burn. That was so. No, thank you. I deserve it. You're also parents and you have to be at that. Yeah. Yes. No, that's fair enough. I've not given birth to anything, so I don't know. I don't understand. Do you make packed lunches? Oh, you must do because your parents. For me? No. I'm not asking for one right now. That would be so nice, mother. That's not nice. When you were like with parents, they're not my parents, by the way. This isn't the the reason I bring it up is I find it fascinating how everyone's. Sort of thinks differently in that way. I used to wear a watch to try and deal with it, but it never made me on time. It just made me angry with my wrists. That was all. I was never like pleasantly surprised. I was never like, oh, it was always like, ah, fuck, just all the time. I might as well have had a wristband that said, oops. Like there was no point. Anything. Do you know what I mean? That's what a watch is. It's pedantic jewelry, isn't it? It's like a passive-aggressive slap band that you have to wear around you. It's an anal bracelet. Well, that's something else. But the reason I bring it up is my dad is a very punctual person. He was a teacher for his whole life, so he had like one job his whole life. So he had like lots of time around that to sort of work out his skills and do work out what his hobbies were. He's a more rounded human being than I am. Like my dad likes the Clash, and he could bleed a radiator. Whereas, like, I like Discover Weekly, and I don't know what blood type radiators are. So, do you know what I mean? There's a thing there, you know, that he can drive like a lorry, he can drive like a minibus and like a coach, and he's got like a, I have a provisional driving license, and I'm 26. A provisional. Anyone else under any other provisionals in? Yeah, a couple. Yes, yeah. Isn't it? It's the how old are you? Do you mind me asking?
23.
You're 23. Okay, that's marginally less embarrassing. that's fine. I just find it because it's like I think it's the most useless piece of card you can own. It gets you alcohol, which is like not the point of driving. You know what I mean? That's the whole. It's so ridiculous because it's like essentially like a provisional driving license is a piece of card that says I can drive. If I learn to drive, which is what a big proviso that is. That's a big if. Like that's, you know, essentially it's a laminated piece of hope that I carry around in my wallet. Police officer's like, can you drive? I'm like, one day. It's so ridiculous. My dad is awesome. He was like born in the country, so he has all those skills as well. Like he can hear bird song and he can tell you what bird that is. He's Shazam. He's Springwatch Shazam. He can hear like macaw, and he'd be like, "Oh, the lower beak's tumble tit." And he's like, "I don't know the birds." Okay, but I don't have that skill and that superpower at all. I have that with one thing. If I hear a certain frequency of beep, I can tell you that my lasagna is ready. Anyway, that's not enough.
So Ben. You seem like an intelligent, composed gentleman, but I want to put that to the test in a little game called What If? So I'm going to give you a hypothetical scenario, and I want to hear how you would react. Does that sound good?
Of course, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, so Ben, you're sat in a comfortable chair in your home, having a generally lovely time, when suddenly the door to the room bursts open, and you walk through the door. You say that you've come from the future to take you with them as you're the only person who can save the world. I mean, first of all, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm so excited. I love a sci-fi. I am desperate to know what I look like, from other angles other than mirrors. I want to know, you know, it'd be so exciting to see my behavior up close. And then also, yeah, a chance to be a narcissistic hero. I'm so up for this.
Oh, that's great. Some people may respond with trepidation, but not you. You're just delighted to see yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think future you would be happy to see past you as well?
I mean, he'd probably be disappointed to see how much time I was spending in my pajamas, but I'm pretty sure, hopefully we'd get along. I think it'd be sad if I didn't get along with myself. Unless I'd gone through an extraordinary, you know, transition of character in the next, you know, 5-10 years.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds like future you is kind of all business. They sort of burst through the door and say that you're the only one who can save the world. What kind of problem do you think there is in the future that your skill set is needed and that only you can do it?
I daren't imagine. it would be what horrible, awful thing has happened? And what horrible thing has happened that has presumably wiped out all of the other mediocre, white, slubby dudes? That means that I'm the only one left who could possibly do, who could possibly save the world. It'd have to be some kind of crisp eating contest or, a key or a bomb or something can only be unlocked if you are good at doing, you know, easy Sudokus. I can't imagine.
Well, Ben, it sounds like you're well up for going with this future you. They kind of say, come with me.
Mm.
You got to save the world. No questions asked. You're going with them, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if I'm that excited about my life in the current period that I wouldn't throw it all away for a fun adventure. I want to time travel. This is, yeah.
Do you bring anything with you, kind of from the present into the future? Do you think there's anything at your disposal that you think might be useful, or that you just don't want to risk losing?
I think I might bring, like, maybe it'd be worth bringing, like, some books or something, just in case they have, like, in the future, some horrible technological thing has meant that, you know, no one reads books anymore, or they think it's, like, outdated technology or something. That would be cool. Or if they were, like, space Nazis who burnt all the books or something, I don't know. I feel like,
oh my god, that's a Hollywood B movie waiting to be written, and only you can write that movie, Ben. Space Nazis.
Maybe that's what they need me for. They need me to write Space Nazis 5, in which I provide lots of, like, anti-propaganda against the space fascists, and that truly turns the people of Earth against them. This film writes itself, buddy.
It's halfway there already. We just need a producer. And Ben, there are no guarantees of getting back to now. You seem to be suggesting that you're kind of cool with that.
It's not the best time in history, is it? I don't know that there's... I feel like, you know, hopefully in the future they have, like, better medicine and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, everything seems to be crap. I'd be interested
to
see.
You could sort of make a fresh start in the future.
Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Well, do you think you would tell anyone that you're going? You know, would you contact anyone?
Yeah, I probably should, shouldn't I? That would. Yeah. I'm quite uncommunicative with most of my friends and family, so I'm quite bad at answering texts. So I do think that maybe if I did go away for, like, 4 days or something, people would probably be like, he's probably just got lost on a walk or something, or he's, you know, he's trying to do a gig in Coventry, and
and lastly, you know, but not leastly, do you think you would be disappointed to return to the present time? Say you avert whatever catastrophe in the future, would you feel kind of used and sort of disregarded if they kind of said, all right, thanks very much, back to 2020 you go? Or do you kind of think you would want to stick around and enjoy the adulation of saving the world in the future?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Well, I mean, it depends on your time space logic, doesn't it? Because if I go back, then I'm still gonna be the guy who saves the world eventually, in that I will be the person who comes back to get me. So I'm still gonna receive that adulation, but as older me eventually. I don't think there's anything wrong in waiting. Also, it's quite nice to, you know, it's like the classic thing, isn't it? Everyone always says, like, oh, it'd be great to be, you know, go back and be a teenager, but with all the stuff that I know now, I could be go back to university or whatever. I'd be such a cool, interesting person if I knew all the stuff that I know now and didn't make all those stupid mistakes.
Yeah.
So I could, you know, I could legitimately do that. I could be like, I know what the future holds, and I know what I'm going to be like, and I can, you know, but...
It sounds also like it would really help you through some of those kind of, you know, a night where you come off stage and you kind of think, that didn't go quite as well as I would have liked it
sure.
to.
Sure, yeah.
But at least I'm going to save the world in 14 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like
it would
be a real security blanket.
That's it. It's like, it's when you got, like, a package coming in, like, 3 weeks or something. You're like, there's a tick in the box in the, you know, on the calendar a few days away. This has all got to happen. It's a safety net. Yeah. Very nice.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I really hope that this comes to pass, and please do tell me in the future if future you does burst through the door, because that would make me feel good having predicted it.
That I would think that you had predicted. I would have thought that future you had come back and told you that it would happen. In fact, if you would, I'm confusing myself now. This is I shouldn't have embarked upon this meta narrative.
I'm now worried that future me is the one that has instigated this crisis that's put the world in danger.
Yeah, maybe you're the villain of the piece.
Oh, that's dreadful. I'm so disappointed at how this turned out.
It is, I mean, it is weird that you knew all about it.
Of course. Who else could know about it other than the person whose fault it was?
Right, right.
Ah, and what a mistake I've apparently made in warning you that this is going to happen and that you're the person to save the world. I mean, I've made mistakes here. Not good.
You've really prepped me for this.
I really have. Ben, before you go and before we finish up, is there anything that you would like to kind of promote or recommend to our listeners? How can we stay in touch with you? How do we get the full Ben Pope experience?
Oh, God, there's not much of an experience currently to experience. You can follow me on Twitter at Ben W. Pope. I have, if you want to watch some of my stand-up, then if you go to my Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/Ben Pope, you can watch some of my stand-up. And if you want to, you can donate a Ko-fi to me, which is just sending me £3.
Brilliant.
Other than that, I don't have an enormous amount to promote, other than people should try as best they can to save live comedy. Please donate. If you have a comedy club in your local area, such as Jericho Comedy, donate to it. They'll almost certainly have like a scheme. So do that. There's currently a petition that you can sign, an open letter, in fact, on the Live Comedy Association's website, in which you can sign an open letter to the government, or to the Arts Council, I think it is, to provide funding for live comedy, because it's in a real state right now, and 75% of all the comedy clubs may close by the end of the year without any option of coming back. So please do that if you can. I'm really not the person to donate to at the moment. Live comedy is.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you, Ben. Well, we'll link to that open letter and to your YouTube and your Ko-fi and your Twitter. We will make sure that people can stay across all of your things. And we very, very much look forward to having you back at Jericho Comedy as soon as possible, because we really love
thanks,
having
man.
You.
Thanks, man. It's always a pleasure.
Ben, thank you so much for giving up your time to be on the podcast. Can't wait to see you again soon.
Yeah, you too, man. Thank you so much for having me. What a dream.
Cheers, Ben. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, there we have it. That was the fantastic Ben Pope. I loved chatting with him. As Ben said, like so many sections of the arts, live comedy is going through a bit of a difficult patch. But unlike many other art forms like theatre, music and dance, comedy is getting no support from the government. And this will inevitably lead to the closure of comedy venues and comedy clubs if action isn't taken. So please do, as Ben said, sign the open letter to the government to save live comedy. We'll include the link in the episode description. And if you can, throw a bit of money at a comedy club. I mean, don't mean throw money, you know, donate money online in a safe, non-aggressive way. And if you have money burning a hole in your pocket, you can also donate to our fantastic charity partner, Oxfordshire Mind. We've raised over £70,000 in the last few years for Oxfordshire Mind, and we'd really love to keep that total going up. And all the info you need to donate is in the podcast description. Please do like, subscribe, give 5 stars, share, all that stuff. It's a new podcast that we're really proud of, and we'd love as many of our brilliant Jericho audiences to enjoy it as possible. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, Google Podcasts, YouTube, SoundCloud. So spread the podcast far and spread it wide. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back with another episode next week. But until then, bye-bye.